Thank you. finishing the set. And today's program with music from Dillian. Track B2 from a 7-inch. I don't know if it was called Young Rain or Thank God She's Pregnant, but it's one of those. Contagious Orgasm prior to that. CD is called Escape. We heard a track called Capillary. We heard a track from the son of Jodorowsky. His name is Adanowski. CD is called Amador. Track is called Basta dell'Oscuro. Alvarez B., great Alan Bishop. Missy Undertaker from 2005's Blood Operatives at the Barium Sunset. Above Ground. The LP is called Gan Iwa, as in the brand of boombox and stereo equipment. They're out in New Zealand. Green Afternoon, the track we heard. Cyclobe before that. Wounded Galaxies, Tap at the Window. We'll Witness the Resurrection of Dead Butterflies, track we heard. And we opened that set with music from Asian Women on the Telephone. I don't know the track. I'm sorry. Freedom, as Mama Told Me, is the name of the CD. And that's everything we heard. Thanks for listening on a weird Monday. Stay tuned, everybody. Too Much Information is next. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org.
Yeah. Did you read that article a few weeks ago in the Times about Dwayne Claridge? He's the guy who started his own private CIA.
I did, and you know, I've been dying to actually talk to you about it because on the one hand it seemed absolutely preposterous, but at the same time I knew, of course, that it had to be true.
It's definitely true. And in fact, I'm working in a similar company that's about 10 times bigger than his.
I thought you were going to do like this startup, like the iPads and hot chicks. Why are you doing this?
Well, I did that. I started a company and ran it for about a week until some guys came to talk to me and made me an offer I couldn't refuse.
So you probably can't tell me the name of this company.
No.
But can you talk about some of the things you're doing?
Operation Persona.
What is that?
It is a counterintelligence, counterinformation campaign. We're creating a network of pseudo-identities, or basically fake people, on Facebook and Twitter. For example, just a little while ago, my team got an operational assignment for Egypt. So we went in, we used the Operation Persona protocols and created a network of virtual dissidents, freedom fighters, anti-government people, concerned mother-in-laws, you know, anybody that might have an anti-government outlook. And we created a network of these people that had a common cause, which was bringing down the Hosni Mubarak presidency.
All right. Now you're actually getting a little kind of offensive, because I watched this on television and there were hundreds of thousands of Egyptians that risked their lives to go out onto the street and protest. So you cannot say that credit actually goes to some spam bot.
Kenny Mahmoud. One of the personas we created for Egypt was a guy named Kenny Mahmoud. And we were able to insert him into many of the important social media groups. Became an insanely popular guy. So he was like this message board connecting lots of the protesters that you saw on TV to each other.
So he wasn't being programmed to say things like, hey, everybody, let's riot.
Not quite. That never happened. Thank God. Before that line was crossed, he was pulled out of Egypt.
Oh, good. Someone remember there's something called, like, ethics.
No. You see, there's this internal government social media network. It's mostly used by the State Department. It's called Corridor. And I don't know how this happened, but somehow Kenny Mahmoud ended up on Corridor.
So your own fake personas are already infecting government networks. So it's actually possible that on a daily basis, you're like talking with covert spam bots.
It gets worse. Someone had engaged Kenny Mahmoud on Corridor. And this guy is a senior agent who is working Operation Wisconsin. And he decides that it is absolutely essential that Kenny Mahmoud be deployed to Madison.
You mean like monitor the fight over collective bargaining?
Well, I don't know. The guy just thought that Kenny Mahmoud had become an expert in organizing nonviolent protests.
This makes absolutely no sense.
Well, I had the same question. When the order came down, I was like, what is this about? But believe it or not, I think he's actually done some good.
Like what?
Well, you remember the guy that pranked Governor Walker and got him on the radio?
Yeah, yeah, I actually listened to that.
Yeah, well, there's one key moment in that tape where the guy is pretending to be David Koch and he says, like, maybe we ought to bring some guys in there and stir up trouble. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I don't understand why the media hasn't made a bigger deal out of that. I mean, this, to me, is evidence that he is a bad guy. I mean, he admitted on tape that he wanted to put Asian provocateurs in the field.
Oh, I agree. I think he wanted to, for sure. And he was thinking about it. And according to my friend's brother, who is running Operation Wisconsin, the reason Walker decided against doing that was Kenny Mahmood. The real credit goes to him.
Five times since you spoke to me last. Congratulate me, I won every fucking case. To the degree that I'm going to go back and I'm going to sue the court for wasting my time.
Why is your life always so crazy?
I don't know. I mean, I know, but you wouldn't believe me if I told you. Am I being recorded?
Yes.
Then I can't tell you the other good thing. Can you pause?
Yes.
Sugar Mama.
What?
I tell you, I don't even have to work anymore because the last time I worked, I met a sugar mama on set.
Sugar mama? And by the way, I'm recording again.
It's the stupidest show. It's called Tara, the United States of Tara, and it was a cattle call, which I usually don't do, but I'll take whatever I can get. It's like at a stupid baseball game, a stadium, and you always get the worst people there. And there was this girl, I kind of liked her because she was crazy, and she was flirting with me, which I kind of, like, got into because no one flirted with me for a while, even though she was, you know, whatever.
How old is she?
She's my age, 50. What a dish. But she kept talking even when they were saying rolling. So they said, please come down here. And they were going to throw her out. So I followed her because I thought it was mean that they were going to, you know, because this is how her life goes. She's a crazy girl, you know. What is she going to do? The PA and the assistant director knew me. And I said, I know, she's just really talkative, and, you know, I made little eyes like, you know, she's crazy. So then they got mad at me, because, like, you know, they have no loyalty. They said, you could leave too, sir. Like, all of a sudden, they don't know my name is Peter, and they always knew that, sir. And I said, all right, well, I don't want to cause any disturbance, and it looks like she shouldn't be by herself, so I'll take her back to her house. So then we get to her car, and I couldn't believe it. She has one of those expensive cars. I can't tell you the... I don't know cars, but it was a brand new car. So it's like, I was talking to her, like, you do extra work and you drive this? Is this yours? Oh, yeah. And I didn't realize till I brought her to her house that, you know, she's very wealthy. I'm retired, she said. She was just kind of keeping it to herself. And then I went inside and her house was a mess. And she had all this equipment, like stereo, amplifier. She had a dubbing deck. But the thing is, when was the last time I saw a dubbing deck? They did this in the 70s. It was like sparkling new. And so was the old turntable and the amplifier. None of it was hooked up. And she had an old TV, not a plasma or anything. It was in an entertainment system. None of it was hooked up. And I asked her, how long have you lived here? 18 years. Like, I thought she just moved in or something. And I still don't know why does she have all this equipment without any of it being hooked up. I start hooking it up for her, and I tell her that I'll be her handyman because she's very flirtatious and all of this. And while I'm being her handyman, I told her, you know, the way I make money is I do extra work, and I get a little money doing nude modeling at this art college down the street. So she's really interested in that. So she wants to know if I would model for her. I realize, oh, I guess I can play this game for a while. And the game entails this, which is don't give them everything they want. Girls love having to wait for it. So I hooked up all her stuff for her. Then I left. And then, basically, she left me like a lot of messages in the middle of the night that I didn't listen to until the morning, and erased them all, and I thought, yeah, what have I gotten myself into? And then I listened to, like, the last rambling message, and it was all about how she wants to kiss me and touch me. And I'll even give you money. I have some money, and I'd love to help you. I just want to help you. Oh, your tires are bald, and it's so unsafe how you're driving. I got 4 new tires, plus alignment, and all the stuff for my car, which is about $500. Plus, I got the gas bill and electricity all paid. The phone company. Remember how that's always getting shut off?
Uh-huh.
Not anymore. Maybe now I can get more than 500 minutes.
Well, see, you're basically milking this poor, deranged, lonely lady for her money.
She's just on a lot of Prozac. She's fine. But I agree that she can give me a bath, which has to happen sometime next week. That's after about $1,500. She wants to give me a bath. Ugh.
Oh, my God.
Am I taking advantage of her, or am I making her happy? She just tells me how happy I'm making her. She has no one else to spend money on. Imagine how sad. Can you imagine how many people in the naked city are sitting there on all this money that they can't use because there's something wrong with them and no one will be their friend? She has a sister in St. Louis that is her only contact. And she has some boyfriend that she keeps calling me his name from like 10 years ago. But that didn't work out. And then she keeps talking about him, but I let her talk, but I don't really listen.
Oh, God.
Sometimes, though, she will get really lucid, and she keeps talking about how she's 50 years old and she has never done anything. She feels bad about that. Like, she thinks we have everything in common when we don't. But she likes songs about changing the world and people doing things, and she feels bad that she's never done anything. So she wants me to do things. She said she wants to, like, manage me, and she wants me to get haircut and wardrobe. And real. She thinks I'm the greatest actor, and she's going to help me be my agent and all this stuff. She just wants to help. So she will be happy because, you know, I will be able to, you know, give her back something very great. I'm sure when I tell her I'm gay, it's not going to even matter.
You don't think that might make a difference?
You know, I'm able to rise to attention no matter what. If it involves someone taking care of my bills.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rise and smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
There's a new documentary film out about the life and music and legacy of singer-songwriter Phil Oakes.
Nobody listens, my apologies to you.
Writer Christopher Hitchens gets what I think is the best line.
There was a difference between people who liked Bob Dylan. Anyone could like Bob Dylan. Everybody did. And those who even knew about Phil Oakes.
The joke was if you really wanted insightful political commentary that really dealt with the social issues rather than a kind of more generalized, more emotionally distant material, you went to Phil Oakes. One of the main aspects of Phil Oakes as a singer-songwriter was his commitment to social justice.
Ken Bowser is the director of the film, There But For Fortune.
He was very big on taking on bullies, whoever they were, whether they were governmental bullies or union bullies. Company bullies. He liked to fight, and his music always reflected that.
In 1962, Phil Oakes moved to New York City. 1962 is also the year Bob Dylan released his first record.
Rambling out of the Wild West, leaving the towns I love the best. Thought I'd seen some ups and downs till I came into New York town.
It was the right time.
People going down to the ground.
And the right place.
There was an incredible magnetism in the early 60s that drew artists to Greenwich Village. Dylan and Phil and Eric Anderson and everybody else. And they were all singer-songwriters. What made Phil and Dylan similar was they were the most political.
That's Phil's brother and former manager, Michael Oakes.
Phil went to Greenwich Village to become the best singer-songwriter in the country. And then he met Dylan and he said, well, I'll settle for second best. The only time I ever met Dylan was when Phil was trying to organize the Broadside Singers, which was the concept to recreate the Almanac Singers, which was Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger, to create a new group of all the young singer-songwriters and to raise money for Broadside Magazine, which was a pamphlet that was publishing people like Phil and Dylan for the first time. And so Phil calls a meeting at the Kettle of Fish, which is a restaurant above the Gaslight, and everybody shows up. You know, Dylan's there, Buffy St. Marie, Patrick Sky, et cetera, et cetera. They're all there. Phil explains the idea, and they all agree except for Dylan. And Dylan said, not interested. You know, and Phil said, no, Bobby, I mean, just think of all the songwriters this will inspire. And Bobby looks at him coldly and said, Phil, you think if I made the basketball team in high school, I'd be doing this shit?
I think Phil felt he was part of a movement where Dylan maybe felt he was separated and alone. Phil, I think, considered himself part of a larger movement, at least, which didn't exclude his ego from being in operation and wanting to be a star or any of that. But it did. It kept him engaged in the political struggle.
The different artistic and political sensibilities of Phil Oakes and Bob Dylan famously collided one afternoon in the back of Bob Dylan's limousine. It's one of those legendary rock and roll scenes. Here's Michael's version of what happened.
To be corny, they say if you remember the 60s, you weren't there. I was there, and my memory might be faulty, but the way I remember Phil telling me the story was he and Bob were going somewhere in limousine, and Dylan had played him. I remembered it as Dylan had played him Blonde on Blonde, and Phil said he thought half of it was some of the best writing Bob had ever done, and half of it was mere filler. And Bob said, "Stop the car!" Threw Phil out of the car. It was winter, and they didn't speak for probably about 4 years after that. They didn't speak.
The only real difference between the version Michael tells and the one most of Phil's friends and colleagues relate is the name of the song that they were fighting about. Most folks are pretty sure it was Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window, which is not on Blonde on Blonde, but rather a single that Dylan released in 1965. Michael also leaves out what Dylan supposedly said to Phil. You're not a folk singer, you're a journalist. Get out of the car. Here's an excerpt from the film.
Dylan despises what I write. I've talked to him at some length about this. And, you know, he can't accept what I'm doing because it's political and to his mind it's therefore bullshit because I'm not writing about myself and my deepest emotions, he feels. In other words, he thinks that I could be, you know, much more honest with myself.
Oh, I am just a student, sir, and only want to learn.
Phil was so vulnerable to him, but Dylan would play with him, you know, the way a cruel person might when you know that you have the full affection of someone else and you toy with it. And that went on over and over with Phil and Dylan, and it was a very big part of Phil's pathology, as it were, I believe.
Here's the man I most respect in the world, Dylan, telling me this. And yet it's been a help to me in a sense, because it's made me question what are my reasons for writing these songs? Am I complete phony like Dylan thinks? Is that true?
The big falling out with Dylan was over can you please crawl out your window? Dylan's in the snow, and said to Phil, get out.
He was such a prick.
1 year later, Phil Oakes performed at Carnegie Hall. It was his first big show, and the hall sold out, just like it did for Dylan in 1963. Some of the performances are later released on a concert album, and you can hear, on the intro to Ringing a Revolution, Phil joking about his relationship with Dylan.
We'll do a song then about revolution. This is a fictional song, a cinematic song. As a matter of fact, the song is so cinematic that it's been made into a movie. John Wayne plays Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson plays God. I play Bobby Dylan. The young Bobby Dylan.
Phil does that a lot. I mean, almost every concert he makes a joke about Dylan. And I think he's doing that because there were too many really stupid comparisons by press, etc., comparing the two of them. And, Phil stayed true to the politics. Dylan sold out. Now, this is empirical because Phil himself wrote article after article about how great Dylan's changes were and how dare you tell an artist, Picasso never should have done that cubist garbage, you know. I mean, come on. An artist is supposed to grow. Phil understood that, and constantly defended Dylan, although that kind of embarrassed Dylan. I mean, there was a TV interview out of San Francisco where Dylan's asked about, what about this thing Phil Oakes wrote about you? He said, I don't care what Phil Oakes says about me. You know, so there is that competitiveness, et cetera. But no, Phil always made fun of Dylan because I think too many people ridiculously try to build Phil up by putting Dylan down, and that is just total bull.
If I took one thing away from Ken Bowser's film, it was just how difficult it was for Phil Oakes to have a career, a life, a story, independent of Bob Dylan. Ken Bowser told me that at one point he was even thinking of calling his film The Other Man.
You know, Phil is always going to be in the shadow of Dylan. But, you know, it's interesting. No one goes, gee, Gordon Lightfoot is in the shadow of Dylan, or Joan Baez is in the shadow of Dylan. Nobody else. No one else makes it part of the narrative. And somehow Phil wound up being in the shadow of Dylan. No one else's narrative is tied to that. When we made this film, it was never about saying that Phil is as good or second best or 18th best. It was about how this guy's life and times were emblematic of what happened in the 60s and what happened in the 70s, that his life was really a mirror of the times. That was as interesting to us as a story. It was never about comparing, you know, this artist to this artist.
Chosen for a challenge that is hopelessly hard, and the only single sign is the sighing of the stars, but to the silence of distance they are sworn. So dance, 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 teach us to be true.
Of course, Phil Oakes has a story, a career, and a life independent of Dylan, and he really was determined to make it on his own terms. Phil's formula for success was one part Elvis Presley and one part Che Guevara. He ironically titled his 1970 album Greatest Hits, and on the cover he donned a gold lamé suit. But the star thing just never happened. He started drinking more and more, which made his manic depression worse and worse. He drove his friends off one by one. And with hindsight, you can see him hurtling toward that tragic day in 1976. But on September 11th, 1973, the Chilean government was overthrown by a military coup, and for a moment, Phil Oakes sprung back to life.
The CIA basically broke the law and arranged this coup. I mean, then Phil was the first person publicly to make that statement and to say that, you know, this was not a military coup. This was a CIA coup. Yeah. And so when this happened, it was like, I have to do something about this. And so he decided he wanted to do this gigantic concert at Madison Square Garden to raise money for the Chilean refugees. And so he gets Pete Seeger to agree, and Arlo Guthrie and Dennis Hopper, and they take out these ads, and it's a total disaster. I mean, they're selling a few hundred tickets, and yeah. It's like, so they're not going to raise money for the refugees. They're going to cost the refugees money. And Phil, coincidentally, was at one of the clubs in the village, and he runs into Dylan. And he says, hey, Bubby, how'd you like a job singing almost for nothing? Quoting one of Dylan's songs. And Dylan says, what are you talking about? And so then they got together later. Phil explained the whole Allende story. And Dylan said, okay, maybe. You know, and said, but don't tell anybody, Phil. Phil said, okay, it's a deal. And as soon as Dylan left, Phil goes out to BAI, goes in the air and says, and Bob Dylan's going to be there. And the whole concert sold out.
I imagine this had to be a really strange moment for Phil, because on the one hand, he pulled off this amazing benefit concert. But the whole thing came down to star power. And it was a power that was different from his own.
I can see you making music, 'cause you carry your guitar. But God help the troubadour who tries to be a star.
When I moved to Kansas City for this radio show job, I thought Nick and I could stay friends. Like, I thought that we could talk now and then. You know, we've always been kind of creative collaborators and grown a lot from talking about our craft with each other. So I never wanted that friendship to end, but we were on the phone maybe 2-3 weeks after I moved here, 2-3 weeks after we broke up. And he mentioned a really cute girl at the party, but how he shouldn't, you know, be with her because she was moving away and she had a boyfriend already, but it was an open relationship or something. And I was like, dude, too soon. Please don't tell me that. But like, he gave me those little bits of details. And then I started noticing this girl on his Facebook wall, like almost immediately afterwards. And like all of the details lined up. Like I saw that she was leaving for another place pretty soon, that she was in an open relationship. Like she had brown hair and sweepy bangs like me, and we had some mutual friends, and I just like got kind of obsessed.
So you are already cyber stalking your ex?
Well, she commented on everything he did on his Facebook wall for at least 2 weeks, like just consistently. Either it was like a like or it was like a full-on comment. I think like one of the tipping points was when he tagged like a coffee mug that he was looking at with her name on it. And that's kind of a way of like either imagining her presence or being sentimental about like something relating to her. And it just was like, that was the tipping point for me. I don't know why. It's so trivial.
So what did you do?
I emailed him like, hey, I'm so sorry, but I'm going to have to like restrict you from some Facebook stuff. Like, it's just getting kind of hard for me. And he was like, no problem. But the thing about Facebook is that I can protect like him from seeing me, but I can't protect myself from snooping into him or snooping into the people who know him. So the only way in the end for us to like completely cut ties was for him to unfriend me, which he ended up doing. And that was the last we spoke. But I can still see when he changes his profile picture. So I still check that.
What do you mean?
Like, if I type in his name, even though I can't see his profile, and even though we're no longer friends, I can see what his Facebook photo is. So that's the extent of our contact now.
And how often do you check that?
Daily. Embarrassing, though.
So are you meeting people in Kansas City?
Well, I meet a new guest on our radio show every day. You know, every day we have someone from like the mayor on the show, or we'll have like a financial advisor or dating expert. So that's a cool way to meet people. But you should not date people who want to go on your show, because it's not for real.
You've tried it out?
I don't know. This one guy runs a local PR firm here where he does these like social media campaigns for potato chip companies, where he takes lots of pictures of people with their potato chips.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
It sounds like a real winner, Andrea.
I guess. I don't know. He has this really cool like loft style apartment in New York. He's a photographer, and it's kind of crazy. Every time he tags a photo of me on Facebook, the caption, it's like my full job title before my name. And that's how you know he's not really your friend or someone who you should be dating, because like, I'm not just Andrea, I'm radio show producer Andrea. Yeah.
So has anything happened with this guy?
Yeah, well, I spent New Year's with him. It wasn't just him, it was him and another guy who'd like to come on our show. But it was weird, they started kind of fighting.
About what?
Over their phones, actually. The PR guy with the potato chips campaign, who does the social media stuff, he is like Mr. iPhone. He was like DJing the party from his iPhone the whole time. Some people at his party were like Apple retail specialists and stuff. He's like Mr. Apple product. And the other guy, he's a systems analyst for the Army. And it's so serious about his Android phone. Like, he tries to convert everyone he meets. And there was a moment where he saw PR guy DJing with his phone, and then he pulls out his Android and starts comparing and showing him his app. And it was like an app attack. Android guy, he started showing off Google Goggles. Google Goggles is this application where you can kind of photograph things and Google will tell you what they are. So we started taking some books off of Apple guy's shelf, photographing them, looking them up. He even tried to take a picture of the cat. Meanwhile, Apple guy is showing Android guy that his phone takes way better pictures. Like, he's been using this phone for a lot of his PR campaigns. He loves to photograph his cat like every day. And between that, he would like flip over and then change the song, then dance a little. I think they were both trying to impress me with their knowledge of their phones. So they were going back and forth with this for like a long time. And I went over and I talked to other people and I went back and they were still talking about it. And it was getting to become, it was almost midnight, and I kind of had to make up my mind at that point, you know, who was going to get the smooch.
Who won this epic battle?
The iPhone guy. I mean, the iPhone, it's just, you know, really good looking. I like its size. But, you know, also Nick had an Android phone. I mean, he didn't just have an Android phone. I mean, it was in our bed every night. It was part of that relationship. So I was just ready to move on.
It didn't used to be so difficult.
Don't talk so loud, please.
Don't answer.
Oh, that Hollywood party.
Yes, Mrs. Granny, here's Miss Christmas.
Hello, please.
Don't answer.
I can't hear you.
Hello.
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 Telephone girls were highly trained, had very melodious voices. They went to a special school for telephone girls. She replaced the telephone boy, which is the original. They decided that boys were too chaotic and mischievous, so they replaced them with girls, sometimes kind of like rolling out new software in the 1890s. And what they did is you would pick up your telephone, and they would say, "What number, please?" And they would physically connect your line physically to someone else's line, either in your town, the country, eventually the whole world. So the power is
all
in
right,
the switch.
Give me the Omaha routing station. See if we can put our calls through
through their switchers. Let's get this console running now.
Tim Wu is the guy who coined the term net neutrality, and he's the author of the book The Master Switch. He's interested in the telephone girls of the internet.
The most obvious candidate in our time is the search engine, frankly, Google. They're not the only one. One very obvious one, the one that has been a source of power for a very long time, are the connections, the actual physical pipes or wires that connect the home to the network, mostly controlled either by phone company or cable. Metaphorically, when you think about the way you might use your mobile phone, for example, what app you're going to download, then the marketplace has a switch-like aspect to it. Basically, the switch is deciding what your choices are, how you get places. Whoever controls what you get to still has a lot of power.
For Tim Wu, the key to understanding the power of these switches is to understand what he calls the cycle.
Every 20 or 30 years, someone invents something which is profoundly new in the communications field. And some of the examples of telephone, radio broadcasting, television, things like that. Profoundly new. And you have an early era of profound optimism, almost utopianism, surrounding these technologies. This idea that we have discovered something which is going to solve society's problems for once and for all.
Now, you should recognize that this is the way we talk about the internet today. But this is also the way people used to talk about other information technologies, like the telephone, television, cinema, even radio.
The degree of optimism surrounding radio would not be exceeded really until the internet in the 1990s. The sense that we had discovered this scientific marvel, which finally put people into connection in a way which we had never imagined before. Many people thought it must be the work of God, that we'd finally found a way to connect humanity in a way. And after this, it was clearly going to change politics, solve our political problems, bring the nation together as one. Even people would say, would make the entire world a single united being, in a sense, all of our brains connected by the power and magic of radio. Today we talk on our cell phones. It's not quite the same level. But, you know, that early hobbyist optimistic spirit, it doesn't show up in economics journals, but it is what drives these early inventions, this idea of, wow. So the upshot of this is that we sometimes tell the story of communications as if it's just a business, but really it is about very idealistic ideas that come into the marketplace, start as crazy utopian projects, and eventually become industries.
Every communication technology of the 20th century goes through the cycle. And while there is no set script or stage directions, there are many constants. For example, every cycle has its business moguls, and every cycle has a supporting role for the government.
There's an incredible power in these networks, and they attract people the same way people are attracted to Washington politics. They attract a certain kind of personality who wants to run a private kingdom. So someone comes along, a strong man, a mogul, a defining mogul, who says, we will deliver a better product and give the American people what they want. The most helpful thing for a mogul in that position is to get government on its side. And in fact, historically, government has often agreed and said, you are right. We agree with you. It will be better for our country if you are a monopolist. AT&T is the classic example, given a monopoly in the 1910s, lasts for 70 years. Radio in the 1920s, big radio, the plan to have higher quality chain or broad network-based radio, NBC and CBS, essentially gains the cooperation, indeed the active assistance of the Federal Communications Commission in refashioning radio from a small, amateur, chaotic medium into a single, centralized set of networks.
Understanding the cycle, Tim Wu says, is crucial if we hope to understand the big question. Is the internet different?
It is no question when the internet's major technologies invented in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, that it was unlike any other kind of communications technology ever envisioned, mainly by its extremely decentralized nature. And it's a fact that no one entity really has ultimate power over the network. The question is whether those design innovations are really enough or meaningful enough to enable the internet to avoid the same powers of consolidation, centralization, and monopoly control, which all of its ancestors eventually fell into. And it's a complicated story. It's one that is the question of our times. If there is a big question of our times, to me it is the internet really different or fated to go back to what happened to everyone else? Is the internet different? The argument that it is different relies on a few things. First of all, that the inventions, the ideas behind it are too explosive and too powerful once out of the box to put back in. The people, customers, humans, citizens, are used to the idea that they go get information when they want to. And the idea of someone getting in the way of that is just crazy to them, and that is impossible to undo. Another idea is that surrounding the internet is not just an ethos, but an entire infrastructure of funding, entrepreneurship, which is hard to displace. So if you have a monopolist like, let's say, Google or Facebook, unlike 100 years ago where they would just continue to dominate, as soon as they start to falter, funding and entrepreneurs will go towards a challenger. You know, that we've created an environment somehow in the Silicon Valley ethos where you create a giant and then you destroy it, and as opposed to keep supporting it. And that is just different, and it's unless you get rid of venture capital financing and entrepreneurship, that will not change. But I would note that every generation, whenever I read history books, every period of time, people think something is different about their time. They're like, there's no possible way that our situation could be like anyone else's. And I think that could be true of the internet. Many things have not changed. The laws of economics have not changed. Companies still derive enormous advantages from economies of scale and network effects. A company like Facebook is popular and dominant because everyone else uses Facebook. Exactly the same with AT&T in the 1910s. Why did people use AT&T phones? Because everyone else was on the AT&T network. Facebook has exactly the same thing. Giant brands that everybody trusts with enormous economies of scale, a company like Google or a company like ABC in the old days, not so much difference. In other words, the ancient economic forces which lead to natural monopoly have not changed and will not change. The other thing that does not and will not change is human nature. And when there has been information and communications, there has been a will to power, a desire to control it that has not gone away. The temptation to be the man in charge of a communications empire is extremely strong and intoxicating. The CEOs of major information firms are not ordinary people. I met Jerry Levine, the old head of AOL, Time Warner, and he said, being a CEO of a media company is a form of mental illness. There is something intoxicatingly powerful about controlling what people are exposed to, what information people get, because in some small way that is influencing who they become. And that has not gone away, and as long as that temptation is there, the temptation to take a monopoly will be great. And whoever achieves an internet monopoly comes into a power that is greater even than that on the old phone networks or the radio networks, because now there is one universal network. You have one network which unifies everything. If you control that, you control everything. And so there is a temptation to seize control of the one ring that controls them all, so to speak.
But if this cycle is inevitable, what will be fundamentally different? I mean, it'll look the same, right? We'll be walking around with these powerful phones, computers in our hands. We'll still have screens surrounding us. I'm kind of wondering if you can just paint us a picture of how different the world will be.
Sure. So if the history repeats itself, we can expect a period similar to the 30s, 40s, 50s, after radio optimism, where you have probably a lot less random content you run into on the internet, more streamlined. And in fact, I think the American population will sort itself, if this is any guide. You'll have sort of something of an Apple nation, more of a Google nation, more of a Facebook, depending on whether you care about your friends, whether you care about everything, getting Hollywood content as easily as possible. That would be Apple, Facebook, friends. Google is you still sort of believe more in the ideals of an open internet and a bit more randomness. So you could see the internet kind of self-sorting into different groups of people who are somewhat separate. You know, forget blue state, red state, and talk about Apple, Google, Facebook states as being different people. And I think that will be a very profound change from what the original ideals of the internet are, is a what I'm calling the big three future of the network. Part of what's made the internet interesting, for me, or was once the defining characteristic, is that it was a place where, whether you actually reached anyone or not, it was always possible to start your own little thing and be heard somewhat. And it's sort of absurd, but you know, my blog or anyone's blog roughly gets equal treatment, or historically, to the blog of someone very wealthy or a major news organization like CNN. You may not have as much visitors, but you basically have the same thing. You have a web page, they have a web page. And there's this rough equality, which has always been the kind of hallmark of the internet. It's a very 70s kind of thing, you know, this sort of radical equality between websites that has been the internet. It's very frustrating to people who either are famous or rich, not people, but also entities, that, you know, that some dude's traffic, a site gets more traffic than in New York, an established entity which thinks it has a lot to say. It has upended a lot of hierarchies in that sense. And the question is whether it will be a force that continues to do that, whether the internet will in some ways have that public character or not. And I think that is what we could lose. Some people will celebrate. Some people will be like, you know, this internet was just a bunch of chaos and junk, and I'm glad it's going back to a little more controlled, planned, straightforward future. But, you know, you lose something there. You lose the vision of it as an agency of free speech.
Yeah, but how do we know when the battle's over? For example, there's a lot of people right now getting behind the concept of net neutrality. But even if you look at what happened in Washington recently, it doesn't even seem like that's really going to solve the problem. Like, how will we know that we've won and the internet is different?
If we look back over the next 10 years from now, and in fact the internet has not really closed, if today's monopolists are in the dustbin or have fundamentally been unseated, and it continues to have this open characteristics, we will know. I would say a decade. Most of these, when I look at these cycles, typically there's about 10 or 20 years of openness at maximum. The internet became popular in 95, we're 15 years into it. So if 25 years later it is still an open, vibrant, innovative medium, we will know that perhaps things have flipped and perhaps communications has changed in a lasting way. Of course, nothing will ever change forever. Forces of centralization are power. They're never going to go away. Just like no democracy has ever permanently solved the problem of not becoming a dictatorship. Right? There's always a possibility of a democracy flipping into a dictatorship, and I think that's exactly how we should think about it. It takes an effort.
Galen Smith lives in Brooklyn and works in Manhattan, and so he spends a lot of his time riding the subway and waiting for the subway.
Living in New York, you know, you see a lot of graffiti, and in the time period in which I've lived here, which is from like the 90s till now, it hasn't been real big classic 70s and 80s train murals, and it hasn't really been that famous New York style that really, you know, got the ball rolling all around the world. It's quick tags and quick throw-ups, not so much big pieces.
The majority of these quick tags end up on the posters on the subway platform.
you know, the knocked out teeth, the zombie eyes, I call, you know, either the blacked out or cut out eye sockets, you know, your mustaches all the way from Chaplin Hitler over to Salvador Dali style. But, you know, I'm a graphic designer, and over time I got past the initial feeling of blur. And then something really jumped out at me. In a way, the most obvious things, like there's penises drawn almost on every single poster.
Galen Smith is the author of New York Dick, a book about the subway penis. A primitive little symbol, to be sure, but one he believes is giving voice to our true feelings about our media landscape.
These posters are ubiquitous. If you haven't traveled in New York, you may not realize that they're on practically all subway platforms, and there are dozens of them. They're all over the place. They're literally in your space. They're about the height you are, and they're large. Very unlike print ads, and of course nothing like video type stuff. And you're sort of bombarded with them all the time. And even if you don't think of yourself as being bombarded, you're hanging with them a lot. And it can get really tedious, especially if there's one you don't like. But in this space, in this context, you really can make your own counter-argument, your own counter-statement, and everyone knows what you mean.
How is this different than, say, like a conventional authored graffiti tag?
Well, I think one of the things that makes it different, and for me makes it really interesting, is that it's even more folkloric. There's no authorship. There's no getting famous, well-known. You're not even really getting a lot of cred with your friends. I mean, your friends may have been here giggling with you when you did it, but it's not really like you're, you know, going all city with these dinguses. No one's claiming this is art. Everyone knows it's a little stupid, but there's something about the idiocy that is part of why it works so well. And like it, in our culture, a way to show absolute disrespect is to draw this penis. It's like that's a very New York-y conversation, or at least how New Yorkers like to see themselves. Very aggressive, moderately clever, and really sort of a disrespectful. But honestly disrespectful. The person drawing the penis didn't start this conversation. They didn't think they were winning and dominating this communication. The advertiser and the system did. And so it's a way of putting some brakes on this rampant and constant getting over on one that advertising seems to feel that it's doing. Now, I like advertising okay. I find it very interesting in a way, and some ads I think are really fun. But a lot of them aren't.
Every time I see one of these penises now, I get kind of excited. It's like finally proof that there are tons of people who feel the same way I do about our ever-encroaching commercial world. Tons of people. And they're all saying the same thing. Screw you. Really, it's awesome.
This is actually happening now with real people making real comments in a real space, and it's more of a community than you might realize. And in New York City subways, there's potentially thousands of people that can join in that conversation or can just witness it and give that sort of, you know, a little bit of a chuckle, a little bit of a nod, like, you know, I'm not saying I agree, but I know what you mean.
This episode of Too Much Information is called What a Difference Makes. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen, and featured Ken Bowser, Michael Oakes, Tim Wu, Galen Smith, and TMI regulars Peter Choice, Andrea Salenzi, and Chris. You can listen to the TMI archive anytime, as well as subscribe to the TMI podcast on our playlist page, which you can find at WFMU.org.
Join us at the same time next week for another edition of Too Much Information. You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WFMU.org. Up now, For the Record, with Dave Emery.
Hello, my name's David Emery, and this is For the Record program number 334, titled The Protocols of the Elders of Oil. This is being recorded on November 4th of the year 2001, and it's yet another broadcast in the series about the September 11th terrorist blitzkrieg, as I call it. This is a very complex event. I attribute the authorship of it to the Underground Reich, which is in and of itself a very complex concept. And I can only refer interested listeners to the other broadcasts in this series and background information in the many other broadcasts that I've produced. Those are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire that I'll tell you about later in the program. And the vast bulk of the For the Record programs are now available on Real Audio, either streaming and or available for download only on two websites run by sister station WFMU-FM. The title, The Protocols of the Elders of Oil, is a slight corruption of The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, an anti-Semitic tract that was one of the linchpins of Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism. And I am bringing this up because in the wake of the September 11th attacks, there has been a great deal of, or an acceleration, I should say, of anti-Semitic rhetoric, not only in the United States, but elsewhere, attributing the attacks to Israel, to the Mossad, etc. And that is basically what we're going to be talking about this evening. Not anti-Semitism per se, but the role of oil. And petrofascism, to coin a term, is one of the central elements in the milieu that authored these events, in my opinion, as is Islamofascism. And I don't want to be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but rather it is an extremist sect within Islam called Wahhabism that we've spoken about before, specifically promulgated by Saudi Arabia and the Bin Laden family that is one of the central elements in this. And it is not Islam, it is Islamofascist, and it is a sect in Islam that has a traditional association not only with international fascism, but also with, and particularly with, the petroleum industry. San Jose Mercury News, Monday, October 22nd of 2001, carried the following article by David Firestone of the New York Times. The Mercury headlined this, Jewish-Muslim Dialogue Falters, subtitled After September 11th, Bitter Disagreement About What is Terrorism? It reads in part, in the weeks since the September 11th attacks, a wide and increasingly bitter gulf has opened between many Jewish and Muslim leaders in this country over the nature of terrorism and the role played by Israeli policies in fomenting Muslim anger against the United States. In several cities across the country, rabbis and Jewish lay leaders have walked out of long-standing interfaith dialogues with Muslim leaders, complaining that the Muslims are condoning suicide bombing attacks against Israelis while condemning the attacks against the United States. Statements by some Muslim leaders that Israel may have been behind the World Trade Center attacks have led to angry denunciations by Jewish officials, endangering relationships that took years to construct. One of the probable reasons for this, aside from the fact that Israeli-Palestinian question is certainly something that is being utilized as an emotional distraction from the actual hard political and economic issues behind this, in particular, oil, the Saudi brand of Islamofascism, as a writer that I quoted in For the Record 329 called it, is being heavily promoted in this country. And again, that Islamofascist sect, so to speak, is called Wahhabism. It is peculiar to Saudi Arabia, is sort of native of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed Wahhab is a native of the city of Najd, N-E-J-D, which was, interestingly enough, actually forecast, predicted by the Prophet Muhammad to be a source of corruption and confusion in the future. Najd is now called Jeddah, and it is now the headquarters of the Bin Laden family. Wahhabism is being actively promoted in the United States by the Saudi government in Islamic congregations. An article about that appeared in the New York Times of Saturday, October 20th of the year 2001. This article is by Blaine Hardin, H-A-R-D-E-N. It's headlined, Saudis seek to add U.S. Muslims to their sect. It reads in part, in a costly and quietly insistent campaign to spread its state religion, Saudi Arabia has been trying for decades to induce American Muslims to become followers of the puritanical Islamic sect that sustains the power of the Saudi royal family. By building mosques across the country, sending Americans to the Middle East to be trained as imams, and promoting pilgrimages to Mecca, The Saudis have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in an effort to stamp their austere version of Islam on the lives of Muslims in the United States. That version is called Wahhabism, although the Saudis are loath to use the term in referring to their proselytizing in this country. As practiced in Saudi Arabia, Wahhabism denies equal rights to women, and its teachings have inspired the violent extremism of Osama bin Laden and the Taliban government that harbors him in Afghanistan. And again, the entire situation vis-a-vis Israel and the Palestinians is fodder for future broadcasts. Neither side is without blame. The fact of the matter is that it is the last unresolved displaced person situation from the Second World War. And to make a very long story very short, the anti-Semitism that is now becoming increasingly popular in the U.S. and in particular in the Muslim world is not only a distraction, but is frankly completely beside the point. Israel has no oil. The Islamic countries, including Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, does, in terms of population, that is. And when you filled up your gas tank last, did you put in A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? This is not hard to figure out. One of the spokespersons who has been very, very visible, in particular in the United States and in particular in more progressive political circles as a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause, and again, that whole issue is a separate issue, and the Palestinian National Movement has very strong links in international fascism and the Third Reich. The most extreme end of the Israeli right wing, including the Likud party, also has links going back to fascist Italy. I've spoken about both of those in many broadcasts in the past. The sort of darling of the progressive sector as a spokesperson for the Palestinian cause has been very visible recently in the United States. That's a woman named Hanan Ashrawi. First name, capital H-A-N-A-N, last name, capital A-S-H-R-A-W-I. An article about Ms. Ashrawi appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, November 4th of the year 2001. This is an article by Tyke, T-Y.